Chapter 3, December 1st, The Night Watch. On November 29th, 2012, what had started so strangely in Gloucestershire on the 21st had become a great terror that had, on that night, struck millions of cities, towns, and villages across the world and expanded from there. Now, on December 1st, the White House that Martin had visited was long since evacuated. Washington was in chaos. The world was in chaos. The stories from the great cities were beyond horror. Rather than face what was happening, people by tens of thousands had gone out of windows in New York and Chicago, leaving heaps of untended bodies in the streets. The country's communications had broken down, fuel and food had ceased to move along highways choked with refugees, and worse had happened. Much, much worse. Harrow, Kansas, however, had not been struck. All the towns in the area had organized themselves and were as prepared as they could be, but so far the problems had not affected Kansas, at least not this part of it. However, with communications down, they really had very little idea what was happening past 30 miles away. Martin was on watch in the steeple of Third Street Methodist when, just before 1 in the morning, he saw light flicker in the clouds that choked the dark west. As he looked more carefully, the clouds lit up briefly. But there were thunderstorms out there, so there would be lightning, of course. Another flash slowly dwindled and was gone. He knew archaeology, not meteorology, but he had never seen lightning that lingered like that. He turned on the little radio that he'd brought up with him, just in case there would be some signal from somewhere. But the world remained as silent as it had been these past 3 days. No radio, no TV, no internet, GPS mostly not working. Landline telephones were sporadic. Cell phones were local only, and then only occasionally. There was no TV, and even the shortwave radio consisted of static, and in the higher frequencies, endless streams of what sounded like some sort of sing-song code, a machine language. Another flash, this one going close to the ground, then expanding and getting brighter. He became aware that his heart had begun to flutter. He faced the fantastic reality. They had come to Lautner County. That light was over Holcomb, not 20 miles away. Nobody had ever seen them. The only thing known was that the 14 lenses, when night fell on them, disgorged thousands of dully glowing blood-red disks, which fanned out, spreading the most appalling and bizarre form of death ever known to man. He picked up his cell phone and called the town's police officer, his friend Bobby Chalmers. "Got some bad-looking flashes in those clouds, Bobby." "I'm looking at 'em." Next, he phoned Lindy. Attempting not to alarm her, he kept his voice casual. "Hey, Dr. Winters." "Hey, Dr. Winters." "Sorry to rouse you from your beauty sleep, but why don't you go ahead and get the kids ready? I think you need to come over here. Looks like we could have some activity coming in from the west." She didn't get a chance to react before his phone started beeping in another call. He clicked over. "Hi, Bobby. Where are you, BTW?" "On my way to you. Ron Turpin over in Parker." Parker was between here and Holcomb, a scattering of trailers and a tumble-down convenience store at a crossroads. "I know Ron." "Yeah. He's saying there's a formation he can see in the flashes moving with the clouds, and nobody's answering the phone over in Holcomb." "But they're working? The phones are working?" "They're ringing. No cops, no sheriff, no paramedics picking up, nothing." "Dear God. You better get down out of there now, Martin." Immediately, he clambered down the 4 flights to the choir loft, glanced out across the dark church, and then went down the stairs to the entrance. Bobby had arrived and was going into the electrical closet as Martin reached the foot of the stairs. Bobby hit the power switches, lighting up the nave, then all the external lights. Martin flipped open his cell phone and called the minister. Reg, we could be getting hit tonight, looks like.
That can't be true.
It looked like Holcomb was getting it a few minutes ago, and now Bobby can't raise them on the phone. Discs passed over Parker coming this way. We're the only town in this direction for 80 miles, Reg.
I'm on my way.
Martin stepped outside. I called Dennis Farm, Bobby said. His phone buzzed. He flipped it open, listened a moment, then closed it.
That was Larry Dennis screaming for help. They got Sally. The light's coming down like rain. Then the line...
He held out the silent cell phone. In both of their minds was the same thought. It couldn't be happening here. It was something you heard about, a big city thing, a European thing, a Chinese disaster.
Wake him up, Bobby said. We're under attack.
Martin went back into the church and started the bell. There was a whirring sound as it began ringing, its stately tones trembling off into the night. His finger hesitated over the siren. It hadn't been sounded since September, when it had been turned on for the tornado that had taken out the Conagra silo and the Kansan trailer park. He flipped the switch, and the siren began as a low growl, quickly increased its volume, then filled the air with its wailing. Across the street, Sam Gossett came to the door in his pajama bottoms and yelled, "Is it for real?"
"Holcomb and Dennis Farm just got it," Bobby said. "It's for real, all right."
The Wilsons, and a family Martin didn't know except to nod to, arrived in SUVs and went hurrying into the church. They must have been sleeping in their clothes. As he passed, Timmy Wilson said,
"They're coming up 6 mile, slow and low."
His words made Martin feel literally sick. He telephoned Lindy. "Hi, hon. What's your situation?" "We're leaving the house." "You need to hurry, Lindy. They're over 6 mile road."
"Oh, God, Martin."
According to Homeland Security, people alone did not survive. None of them. Not ever. Groups, supposedly, had a better chance. They still got flyers dropped from time to time. He speculated that Beau Waldo might have something to do with that. There was a man who was not going to be beaten, unlike those two generals who'd been edgy, bitchy thoroughbreds. "Lindy, cut across the Walker place to the highway."
"I'll wreck their garden." "Do it now."
She closed the phone. Unless something else just happened. A wave of nausea almost made Martin gag.
"You okay?"
Bobby asked. "Lindy's out there with the kids. Where's Rose?"
"Same thing. Coming in as fast as she can."
"But not down 6 mile road."
"God damn, buddy, that's right."
Bobby, who had been his friend since their boyhood in this community, met his eyes. Bobby had stayed. Martin had gone on to university. But he'd returned in the end, discovering after Berkeley and Stanford that one did not leave Kansas so easily.
"I never thought this would come," Bobby said, as the two of them watched the sky and the people now hurrying into the church.
"We're not in Kansas anymore, Bobby. Kansas is gone with the wind, I'm afraid."
"You think it's gonna be all of us, Martin?"
A wave of what could only be described as woe swept over Martin. He said, "The pamphlet says that more survive if we congregate." It had been dropped by Homeland Security last week.
"What I feel like doing is hiding. That's what feels right."
"I would assume that we can't hide." The pamphlet, which had been dropped from a Goodyear blimp of all things, was the only defense the government had offered. In fact, the most terrifying thing about the whole business was the silence from Washington and Topeka. George and Moira Fielding came huffing up, she in a slip and bra, he in baggy boxer shorts and flip-flops.
"There's screaming coming from down the end of Constitution," he gasped.
Serenity Lodge, 40 old folks. Martin looked at Bobby. "You want to go over there?" He thought to himself that Lindy and the kids must pass right in front of the place on their way in.
"I'm needed here."
It wasn't cowardice. It was simple truth. Across town, Martin could see the steeple of the First Church of Christ light up and heard its bells join theirs.
St. Peter's was invisible behind the huge oaks that stood along Evans behind Main, but he knew they'd be lit up, too. They didn't have a working bell. Emma Hurd got out of her car.
There was that light, just like they say. It was horrible, horrible.
You were at the home?
I was in my office when, oh, Jesus, I tried to help them. They were all in their rooms.
She broke down in sobs, and Martin looked off down Third, looking for some sign of Lindy's blue Dodge truck.
Did you see any actual attacks? Bobby asked.
When I ran out, I saw the light coming down on the building out of one of those things, the disks. It looked like some kind of goop, a glowing membrane, really bright, like on Nightline that time, that video of it. I got the hell out of there, let me tell you.
She lowered her eyes.
I saw it slide down in the windows, and I heard, oh, Bobby, the screaming.
She paused, then added in a tiny voice,
They're all headed north now. Every single one of them that can walk, and in their pajamas, poor things.
Then she noticed Martin. She came close to him. At 40, she was still beautiful. She'd been his older woman when he was 14 and she 20. They had cuddled and touched, and he'd learned mysteries from her that still inspired the deep, deep joy he took in women, in Lindy now, only her. She clutched at his shirt. He took her by the shoulders and turned her toward the church.
Go inside. Do it now.
She walked away with a curious, gliding motion. Martin watched her.
You sure she's not affected? Nah, that's just shock, Bobby said. Right out of the book.
Jesus will help us, Mrs. Oates said as she came up the walk. Never you mind. Jesus will help us.
She went past them, unseeing, glassy-eyed with terror.
The Lord sure hasn't been helping us much lately, Bobby said, but softly, as if it was a kind of dirty secret, or what he was more likely to think, a blasphemy.
As a scientist, Martin had grown past his childhood piety. Nowadays, while he wasn't against religion, he just didn't see the mechanism of the spiritual. Bobby and Rose brought their kids here to Methodist every week. Martin and Lindy had chosen not to visit the burden of organized religion on Winnie and Trevor. Trevor had been delighted at not having to join the acolytes of the Anglican Communion in America. He dreaded Latin. People everywhere were taking the horrific business that was unfolding in the world to mean that the soul was real. No less a luminary than the physicist Sir Roger Penfold had called it the profound organ because of the way it appeared to control memory and emotion. Given that it consisted exclusively of electrons, the belief that it was immortal had turned out to be entirely correct. Energy is indeed immortal. But could it be conscious in its own right outside of the body, or remain a coherent structure after death? Martin didn't understand how that could be, and he doubted that anybody else did either. He did understand the extraordinary irony that the attack on the soul was what had led to its discovery. The scientific community's soul blindness had only been lifted when the human soul began to be taken, and we could see, hear, and feel the consequences. To Martin, as a scientist, this did not mean that the gods were therefore real, but the average person had taken proof of the soul to mean that his particular gods also existed. So churches and temples across the world were jammed day and night with people pleading for help from their deities. Martin viewed things differently. He was fascinated that this plasma could be drawn out of a human body, as shocked as everybody else at the changes that resulted. But as far as it being the Ka of the Egyptians, the Jiva of the Hindus, the Hun of the Chinese, any of those concepts, the folkloric soul, well, that remained unproven. It was simply an organ of a type they had not previously recognized, with a profound function, most certainly. In fact, a function that explained why we were different from animals, because of the way it preserved memories and delivered them to the brain for processing. But it had not confirmed the reality of the gods, at least not for this intellectual, nor was it clear that it survived in any coherent way after death. Clearly, though, the removal of the soul was hell on the organism, and it was hell here in Kansas tonight, and maybe across the entire country. But before communications had failed, the real hell had been unfolding in the jam-packed, exposed third world, with swarms of the disks gushing each night like vast formations of locusts out of the 14 great black lenses that ringed the world, and people by the millions being torn apart in this strange new way night after hellish night. He pulled his worn copy of the Homeland Security pamphlet from his pocket. Approach damaged individuals with extreme caution. Their state is unknown, and while generally passive, they can be unexpectedly violent. Martin had seen some of the people who'd been disensouled, as the media had called it when the media still existed, a cluster of six of them. Ragged on the roadside, stragglers up all this way from the Garland, Texas attack that, for America, had signaled the beginning of the nightmare. They'd been walking in a rough line. They were filthy and stinking, sewer drinkers, carrion eaters, muttering and growling to each other as they shuffled aimlessly along, aware, perhaps, of some loss, but no longer understanding what it was. He had stopped his car because he hadn't been able to resist at least observing them from a little closer, despite the Homeland Security warnings. They hadn't seemed dangerous at all, far from it. Up close, they were more like migrating elk or something. He'd spoken to them. Nothing. There had been two men, three women, some children, one on the back of one of the men, the others hand in hand with their mothers. He'd walked beside them, touched a woman's shoulder, and asked her, "Could you tell me your name?" She had turned to him, and what had happened was the most dreadful thing. She had smiled at him, but such a strange, strange smile, all wrong, so bright that it was empty, not cruel at all, but relentlessly innocent, like the smiles of poor Jim Tom Stevens had been when they were kids. Jim Tom was retarded, though, and he had not had the feeling that these people had been made stupid. No, it was much stranger than that. They had not lost their intelligence, but rather their information. And not how to count or how to read. Oh, no, the information they had lost was much deeper. What they had lost was what distinguishes us from animals, the arrow of consciousness that points inward. They still knew and saw the world. The information that they had lost was that they were, and for this reason had ceased to be human. They had become brilliant animals. For all of Jim Tom's intellectual poverty, he was not this lost. He knew that he was. When you called his name, he did not simply come to a familiar sound, as an animal might. He turned to you with an expression in his face, the fundamental human expression that says, "This is me." Martin had been reminded of a line of poetry. "With its whole gaze, a creature looks out at the open and sees nothing of himself at all, has no self." They'd hurried off, moving in the general direction that all wanderers moved, at least around here, which was north-northwest. He had sat on the terrace all afternoon watching the leaves run in the yard and trying to make sense of what he had seen. He had told Lindy that they had reminded him of Jim Tom, who had been so innocent that he would eat raw roadkill if he happened upon it hungry. "If you taught them," she had asked, "do you think they could learn?" "How to drive a truck or something, sure, but not concepts, no." "Then they've been made stupid." "I didn't get that impression." What impression did you get then?
He'd considered his reply for some time. Finally, he said, The difference between us and a brilliant animal is that the animal understands what is, but not what it means. I think they'd been returned to what we were before the discovery of our being made us human. They weren't human, Lindy. They were just sort of there.
As a scientist specializing in the past, he was well aware that the human body and brain had evolved 100,000 years before civilization had appeared. We'd been brilliant animals for a long, long time, and in the dark back of his mind, he feared that whoever was here was not really destroying or capturing souls, like people believed. Not at all. It was much simpler. They were manufacturing slaves. And the reason the wanderers all went off in the same direction was that they weren't wandering at all. They were moving to a collection point. As far as the souls were concerned, pulling them out of the body was like letting the air out of a balloon. They became part of the general electromagnetic flux. In effect, they disintegrated.
People swarmed into the church now, in pajamas and underwear and whatever, coats thrown over shoulders, hats jammed onto heads. The one thing they all carried was a gun, many of them more than one. Pistols, rifles, shotguns, a few assault weapons, a formidable arsenal. May Witt got the organ started. It burbled for a moment, then blasted into a brave rendition of What a Friend We Have in Jesus. A moment later, a scream pealed in the street, the sound rising above the wail of the siren, the tolling of the bell, and the hymn. 10-year-old Chrissy Palin pointed at the sky. At first, Martin saw only first moon, pale and serene, speeding in ragged clouds. Then Tom Palin raised his .30-06 and fired, and Martin's eyes followed the muzzle flash to a simple ovoid, dull orange against the sky, as motionless as if it was fixed to the ground. Martin scoured the street for Lindy's Dodge. He put in a call to her, but could not get a signal.
"We need to get out of the street," Bobby cried. "Everybody, run! Run now!"
Despite his lack of religious belief, Martin found himself begging God in his heart to bring his family to him safely. He breathed the words in and out, God, please!" and tried to send some sort of protection to his beloved and their kids, his striving preteen boy and his darling little girl. The object slid over right-way drugs, then backed off to the target end of town. Then Lindy was there, getting out of the car with Winnie and Trevor, and the disc was there too, sliding back across the sky as if it was on a tabletop.
"For God's sake, run!" Martin screamed at them. "Shoot at the goddamn thing, Tom! Shoot at it!"
The rifle cracked again, and the thing slid away into the darkness. Bullets were rumored to slow them down, but not for long. Lindy and the kids came toward Martin as if in a slow-motion nightmare, like ballet dancers executing a pas-de-deux, like a little boat drifting in a calm. The thing reappeared, speeding into view at rooftop level. Electric fire crackled along its edge, spitting sparks into the air. The Palins raced into the church, and Martin realized that his family was not going to make it. He ran toward them, his blood pumping, his legs going fast, but not fast enough, as the thing dipped low over Main Street not 100 yards behind them and began moving forward. It was about to hit them with a light. He knew it.
"Run, Lindy!"
Whereupon Lindy, God love her, turned and shouldered her bird gun and let go 4 blasts of buckshot. The thing seemed unaffected. Bullets delayed them slightly, but buckshot apparently not at all. The kids reached him.
"Get in the church!" he shouted to them, pushing them toward the lighted door.
Lindy, he saw, had returned to the car for a backpack of provisions. The bell tolled, the siren moaned, and the congregation sang in ragged chorus, "He'll take and shield thee, thou wilt find a solace there." Bobby yelled, "Move, move, move!"
Lindy came out of the car. She seemed to be underwater. She was moving so slow. And then Martin saw why. She was falling. She'd tripped. He ran toward her.
Reg Todd called, "We're closing the doors!"
Winnie and Trevor realized what was happening and began to shout, "Mom! Dad!"
"Martin, it's right over you. It's starting to glow!"
Bobby pulled out his service revolver and fired at it. The street around Martin began to turn red. Still, he ran toward Lindy. He could not conceive of abandoning her. Her skin was red in the red light from above. He threw an arm around her and began pulling her forward. As they got to the church steps, she gained her footing and began to help him. As she fell into the foyer, Maggie Hastert came to her rescue, and the two women staggered into the last pew as Bobby and Martin slammed the doors.
"Mom!"
Trevor shouted.
"Mommy!"
Winnie shrilled, the littlest finally realizing that something was not right in her world.
"Mama is all right," Lindy managed to gasp. "You're crying,"
Trevor said.
"We're all crying, Trevor," Martin said.
"Are we supposed to be crying?"
Winnie asked. Martin moved into the pew with Lindy, with their kids clinging to them, and the Hasterts made room for them. Given that Rose had arrived with their kids, Bobby and his family were okay too for the moment. Reg Todd went into the pulpit. Martin liked him, had hunted with him when they were boys.
"Everybody's praying now all over the world, calling on the power of God to defend the soul. There is wisdom for us in the Bible, the book of the soul written by God, written for this time when we are discovering our souls because we are losing them. So you listen now. If the light comes..." There was a scream. Everybody looked around, but it had come from outside, from above the building.
It was repeated, and children all over the small nave began screaming too, and Peg Tar cried out, and Bobby tried to calm her down, and she shook him off.
"It's my husband," she screamed. "I know it's him. I can feel it."
She backed away from her neighbor, pushing into Dr. Willerson.
"Where's the Air Force? Where are the planes?"
she bellowed. He shrank away from her, fumbling as his glasses flew from his face.
"The planes!" she screamed. "The planes!"
She grabbed his shoulders and yanked at him so hard she ripped his coat, and he reached back and slugged her, which snapped her head to the side and made spit fly and made a sound like an exploding light bulb. Then the scream outside repeated. It was a human sound, and involved such extraordinary anguish that everyone in the church screamed with it, a roaring agony that, in embracing it, only made it more terrible. Children collapsed, their mothers going down with them. Ron Biggs of Biggs John Deere, fourth generation in tractors, emptied his 12-gauge into the ceiling, a Remington notched with the lives of 41 bucks and happy days. As bits of plaster and angels and clouds rained down, a hideous scraping sound slid along the shingles, ending with a thud in the side yard. Silence then, followed by little Kimberly Wilson singing, "A hunting we will go, a hunting we will go, hey-ho the derry-o," until her mother hushed her. Total silence. This was not what they had been expecting. Now, a murmur among the congregation. Bobby looked to Martin. "Any idea?" Martin shook his head. This wasn't supposed to involve people being dropped onto roofs, but that's what it had sounded like.
"Doctor," Bobby said, "let's you and I go out and take a look around."
Rose said, "No."
"Rose, I..." "Bobby, no. You stay in here."
There was a silent look between them. She knew Bobby's duty, and finally turned away, her eyes swimming. Bobby and Dr. Willerson crossed the room, went out the vestry door. The body, if that's what it was, had fallen down that side of the church. The congregation stood in silence, waiting. Some bowed in prayer, other people simply staring. When they returned, a moment later, the doctor said into the silent, watching faces, "I believe it is Mayor Tarr. He's dead from a fall. He had a rifle. I believe he was on the roof, trying to defend us, and lost his footing." Peg fainted. As Ginger Forrester and her boyfriend Lyndon Lynch, who had been sitting with her, moved to help, there came more screaming, fainter, but from many more throats. One of the other groups was under attack. Bobby went to the main door, opened it for a moment, then returned. "It's St. Peter's," he announced. Mel Holmes said, "This is insane. What are we doing just waiting like this? Tarr had a point. Let's go outside. Let's put up a fight. For God's sake, let's fight." "Our fight is in our prayers," Red shouted. Mrs. James cried out loudly then and shook her fist, a gesture that must have been repeated billions upon billions of times on Earth over these past terrible weeks. "I want to read now," Reg called out. "I have a text, and then we will pray. We will pray all night, and the children can sleep in the pews."
"No way am I going to sleep," Trevor said.
"Me neither,"
Winnie added.
"Okay, kids, hush," Lindy whispered.
Winnie pulled on Martin's pant leg.
"I'm real thirsty," she whispered.
Oh, it's in the street," Lindy said. "When that thing..."
"We have plenty," Jim said, producing a bottle of Ayers water. "This is from the book of Isaiah," Reg announced. "Listen to this. Isaiah 55. You can turn to it in the Pew Bibles. It's page 435. He read, "So shall you summon a nation you knew not, and nations that knew you not shall run to you because of the Lord your God, the Holy One of Israel, who has glorified you. Seek the Lord while he may be found. Call him while he is near. Let the scoundrel forsake his way and the wicked man his thoughts. Let him turn to the Lord for mercy, to our God, who is generous in forgiving." At that moment, the lights went out. There was a roar from the whole congregation, ringing loud, shrill with terror. "Let us pray," Reg called into the din. "Let us pray." Voices dropped. Flashlights came on. But there also came another light, crawling along the tops of the stained glass windows of the Birth, Youth, and Ministry of Jesus that lined the west wall. Martin watched, unable to turn away, transfixed with horrified fascination. As the congregation realized that it was there, silence slowly fell, became absolute. They watched it coming down, this most terrible weapon that had ever been in the world, and yet so strange, so unexpected. As a scientist, Martin tried to use what skills of observation he could muster. It moved like a thick liquid, this light. We had slowed light down, stopped it, reversed it, but had never created anything like this. When it began to come in, there was a sigh in the room. Just the softest of sighs, no more. And a little girl's voice piping,
"Look at the pretty, Mommy. The pretty is on Jesus."
The painted glass with the bearded figure on the cross, the rough rocks and the praying virgin in her chipped blue glittered with new life as the light ran along them, seemed to pause as if it was looking out across the congregation, evaluating them, scanning them, tasting of them. And then it came on, glaring on their upturned faces.
"Dad, is this an alien being?" Trevor asked.
"It's Lucifer," Winnie said. "Be quiet, or he'll come after us."
Some children began to cry, and a ripple of panic spread. Parents held them. Martin saw immediately that the thing moved like something alive, and something that felt no need to be careful, not the way it came surging in the windows, filling the room with its slicing glare. He was fascinated by its motion. He couldn't help himself. It was a little like the spread of a membrane, he thought. But then it came forward so quickly that there were shrieks of literal agony. The terror was so extreme. Old man Michaels dropped to the floor with a thud. He went gray, and Martin thought he'd probably died. A stench of urine and feces filled the air. Children broke away from their parents and began running toward the doors, in their terror imagining that they could escape. Mamie Leonard dashed after Kevin, but the boy reached the vestry door and threw it open. Glare literally gushed in. The boy cried out and jumped back, but the light swept around him. Martin observed only a flicker, and the child went still, standing in the body of it, surrounded by it, his jaw agape. His mother raced to the far side of the nave and stood there shrieking again and again, sorrowing cries that dominated the room.
Ridge cried out, "For my thoughts are not your thoughts, nor are your ways my ways, says the Lord. As high as the heavens are above the earth, so high are my ways above your ways, and my thoughts above your thoughts."
The light moved and expanded, crossing the sanctuary and flowing down into the nave. People got up on the pews to keep their feet out of it, but Martin knew it was useless. It would do its infamous bloom any second, and then, well, he could not imagine it. He just could not. There was no sign of any biological material. It was definitely a plasma. He could see that, but it had the stability of a highly organized membrane. He tried to think of any bas-relief, any wall painting, any sculpture, anywhere in the world that reminded him of this, and could not. This was new, he was pretty sure, to the experience of mankind.
"Pray now," Red said. "Pray, and hold the children, and be ready with the guns."
Martin put his arm around Trevor, and Lindy picked up Winnie, and Martin felt the pistol in his pocket. He'd loaded it with hollow points. A shot to the head would destroy a child instantly, but Martin did not frankly know if he could do it. God willing, Homeland Security was right about the value of congregating, and they would survive.
"Shoot it,"
a voice said.
"God help us, shoot it."
"Don't do that," Bobby shouted. "That spreads it, we all know. That—"
They were suddenly surrounded by the strangest thing any of them had ever experienced, a flickering mass of colors that hurt and felt good against the skin at the same time, and felt like somebody was watching you, not with malice, but with a sort of evaluative skill that seemed almost professional. Martin thought, "We are destroyed. A destroyed species. This is how we end. Killed in a way we do not understand by something beyond our knowledge." And then also thought, "But it's the way cattle die every day. Or used to." He glimpsed a man, lean, dark hat over his eyes, face of a snake, sliding toward him. He shook the hallucination off. They'd all heard stories about this phenomenon. It was the mind trying to force the impossible into some form that it might be able to understand and thus to fight. Now Trevor closed his eyes.
"Dad, I'm seeing a sort of snake."
He opened them.
"In my mind. Watching me in my mind."
Children's voices were raised.
"There's a cobra, Mommy. A dragon. Daddy, a python!"
And he knew where the ancient tale of the snake originated. It was how the mind of man gave form to disincarnate evil. There came a dull sound, like one of those deep thuds that never seemed to find an explanation that one sometimes hears back in the woods. But something had changed. Reg had changed. Where he had been in his pulpit, with his Bible in his hand, wearing an old gray suit with no tie, now stood a man who appeared to be wearing the most intricately beautiful colored coat ever devised. But it was not cloth. The colors came from tiny, exquisitely detailed memories, each one full of life and motion, swarming around him like living jewels. He threw back his head and roared like a maddened gorilla.
A passage from the Bible occurred to Martin, the one about the coat of many colors. He understood the message. Joseph's coat had been his soul. The old biblical authors, therefore, had known what souls looked like. They were seeing Reg's soul being sucked from his body the way a monkey might suck the pulp from an orange. Nobody made a sound now. Nobody dared. But every single one of them hoped in his heart that this would be enough for it. This would be an end of it. After Reg, it would go. Reg began to physically distort, his face growing long, his eye sockets stretching into bizarre vertical ovals, his lips opening, mouth gaping, and then all over the room others did the same, their faces twisting, colors oozing like gorgeous pus out of their bodies. They pissed and shat and howled and writhed, sinking down, tearing at their throats. There was a deafening wham as Millie Fisher blew her boy Timmy's head apart.
"Mother!" Winnie shouted into Lindy's face. "What is this? What is this?"
Crackling became screeching, became sucking, deep, the sucking of a chest wound, of a woman of the night, and the congregation became a blur of light and struggling, writhing people, some of them clawing at themselves and howling, others with guns in their shaking hands trying to kill the ones who were being destroyed, as if it mattered, as if it would help. It remained like that, people crawling, leaping over one another, and running for the light-choked doors, wading in it, pushing against the warmth of its ghastly fleshiness.
Then came darkness, then silence, broken by a single racking sob. The chandeliers flickered, and with their return came the sense of a storm having passed. The minister still stood in his pulpit. From a middle pew, somebody asked, "Reg? Reg, are you okay?" The Bible dropped from Reg's hand, hitting the floor beside the pulpit with a crack like a shot. In the pews, some people shook others, calling into blank faces, shaking them until the spittle flew. "Angie, honey, Angie, you're okay. She's okay. It didn't do her." Martin saw Angie Bright, Carl Bright's wife of 30 years, looking at him with the blank innocence of a newborn. Others began to growl, to laugh, to back away toward the walls. As the minister did this, he laughed softly. His face was still his own, but it was empty, the eyes glassy, staring. Bobby came to the center aisle, then trotted up to the pulpit.
"Okay, we have the law on our side. We need to do this, people."
My baby is fine. Lucy, you're fine. She's fine."
Becky Linder shook her 12-year-old.
"Lucy, Lucy, don't you play act."
The girl, who had been plastic like a catatonic, lunged at her mother, biting as a dog bites when it is cornered and cannot get away. Becky cried out, falling back into the Baker family, and young Timothy Baker caught her in his arms. Then Carl Bright screamed as he realized that his teenage son Robert also was among the wanderers. Martin's heart was torn by all he was seeing, but the families like this one were the hardest. The Brights lived back in the hills in a comfortable house. In fact, it was only a few miles from their own place. He was a technical writer. She ran an online crafts business. Without so much as a murmured warning, Mrs. Haggerty leaped on Lindy's back like a lioness leaping on a wildebeest, and she lurched forward into Martin, and the three of them went down with Mrs. Haggerty ripping Lindy's hair out in handfuls while her husband, crying out, dragged her off and took her into the aisle. "Kids, don't look," Martin shouted as young Haggerty shot his mother dead. Lindy and Winnie and Trevor turned and moved to the back of the church. Martin was confused by this. "Lindy? Hey!" Another shot from the back of the sanctuary, and one of the Desmond boys stood over his father's body, looking down out of tear-flooded young eyes.
"Mama, I did it! I did it!" he cried,
and his mother took him to her and buried him in her embrace. Phil Nippa, whose wife was gathering at the back of the church with the others who had been ruined, asked Martin, "What happens?" Martin ran to his family. Hey, this... His Lindy had reached the door. She stood with the others. Lindy? Oh, no!
Bobby came up to him. Hey, come on, guy.
But they didn't. Nothing happened to them. He laughed. She's in shock. Hey, Lindy.
He went down to his kids.
See, they're fine, Bobby. They're just following their mother. Winnie, Trevor, stop this. Stop this.
Phil said, And that day the Lord with his sore and great and strong sword shall punish Leviathan, the piercing serpent, even Leviathan, that crooked serpent, and he shall slay the dragon that is in the sea.
The new wanderers crowded the entrance, pressing against the doors, slapping them, and Lindy and Trevor and Winnie were doing it too. And then Bobby put his hand on Martin's shoulder. Martin turned, and when he saw the gun that his dear old friend was offering him, the anguish that ripped his heart caused him to throw his head back and cry out, and in that quiet part of him that is in us all, and sees and knows all, a voice said, This has happened. This is what you have now. Lovers, wives, husbands, children, all circulated among them, trying to communicate with them, and the church was filled with their tears. Bobby got the door open for them, and they went out into the street, and joined many others, a shocking number, all walking away into the night. Martin thought that it was more than half the town, three quarters. They shuffled silently off toward the low water crossing and the back roads that led up into the smoky hills, hardly hills at all, but wilder than they looked from a distance. A few people ran after them, two husbands, a wife, some others who had exchanged death promises. If it happens to me, don't let me be like that. Pacts made in blood and love. Martin ran too, touching his love, calling to her, calling to his babies. Kids, come back here. This is Dad. This is an order. And to his wife, Oh, Lindy, wake up, love. Wake up, love. But they did not wake up. None of them woke up. An arm came around Martin's shoulder, the arm of somebody he knew vaguely, but who now seemed like a savior. And he leaned against this man and wept. And in the street, the little clusters of those left behind wept. And the wanderers went on down the street, disappearing into the dark. Martin ran after them again, and then he stopped, and he went to his knees, and he howled her name, Lindy! He cried in rage and in anguish as she went off without even a backward glance, taking his babies and his love and all that meant anything to him with her into the night. The shattered town sank away into the horrible small hours, with weeping in the churches, and the bodies of the destroyed dead lined up with what little dignity could be managed on the lawns. Most of the ruined, though, were not killed, because people did not have it in their hearts to rip the life out of the familiar and the beloved, no matter their state. So they went away, absorbed by the night. When daylight came, people would seek them out, taking water and food to the empty shells of their loved ones, trying to feed them, to talk to them. And they would smile, the wanderers, or sometimes lash out like scared animals, but the followers would stay with them, begging, pleading, praying, trying anything to bring them back. It is an extraordinary anguish to say goodbye to your dead while they are still alive, and many, many people could not do it. Martin went to his feet. He would not be a follower. He vowed that. He would be a fighter. Somehow, He was going to rescue his love and his children. He was going to go out there into that darkness, and whatever it took, whatever was needed, if he give his blood or his life or his own soul, it mattered not a bit. He would rescue his family. Toward dawn, there was a fall of dew, and morning came pearled with it, on the leaves of autumn and the yellowing late grasses, on the neat houses, the empty streets, and on the wanderers, too, far out in the rustling fields, shining on their pale skin, pearl upon pearl.